Hello. Welcome to Media Network Plus from PCJ Radio International. I'm Keith Perron. Now, when people think of ethical jobs, ones that come to mind, of course, immediately would be, say, doctor and, let's say, teacher. Journalism, on the other hand, is a little bit different. Even though many journalists actually try to keep very high ethics, sometimes there are conflictions. On today's program, a special panel discussion that was hosted by Richard Ady on ethical conundrums involving the media. His guests are Hugh Remington, a presenter from 10 Eyewitness News Sydney, Alex Lee from BuzzFeed News, and Michelle Guan from The Weekend Australia. His first question was to Michelle Gunn, and it concerned the picture of a small boy whose body had washed ashore off one of the boats of refugees that was making their way to Europe. He asked her, should this picture have been published?
Look, I've been thinking about this in recent days in preparation for this, and I think the picture of the little boy in that case is galvanised opinion and really prompted the world to think about what was going on in terms of the refugee crisis in Syria in a way that perhaps acres and acres of analysis that we'd certainly been running in the lead-up to it didn't. And I think that there are certain images, like the little boy, maybe like the napalm picture that is very famous from the Vietnam War, that really have the potential to turn the tide of history.
Hugh, what about you? Because TV news is in the business of images, if above all things, really.
Mm. Well, we had the debate there. We've got a slightly different set of circumstances because the major 10 news goes to air at 5 o'clock and it's actually classified as children's viewing time. The difficulty there is not do you somehow convey the picture, it's do you blur the body of the child. There was the picture of young Aylin on the beach, then there's the picture of the Turkish police officer or whatever he was who was carrying him up the beach, in which the child's body was somewhat obscured. And the power of it was so absolute. It did immediately cause political change in a range of ways, including having our immigration minister flying off to Europe to make arrangements to bring in Syrian refugees, to hasten the act of bringing an extra lot of Syrian refugees to Australia. That was just here, and of course it was having enormous impacts in Europe at the time. So what do you do with the picture? How much do you have to do? To my mind, the power of the picture lay in the reality of that child. So blurring it so that you say behind this pixelated blodge is a body of a child is not the same as saying, look, here is a boy and he's dead and he's one of many. What do you do? For us, the decision was taken somewhat out of our hands by the classification element. We blurred the picture. So what happens if you're after 6 o'clock? I would have made a judgment. I would have shown the image. That's what it is. People should be able to see it.
What did you make of it, Alex?
When I first saw it, I think it was in my Facebook feed, and I think I originally really didn't like that it was just there, and I think I've changed my mind. You know, even within that day, I thought this picture is actually really powerful and it needs to be out there, and I think the fact that it was just that moment captured by a professional photographer and there was, you know, some thinking behind how that photo was made. So it was right for us to show it. And when it's obviously impacting so many people and so many people are being moved by this picture and sharing it, then there's no reason why we shouldn't as well.
You've all talked about the galvanising effect that the image had, but of course not all shocking images have that galvanising and sort of, if I could put it this way, fundamentally positive effect. So Hugh, what about the passengers from the Malaysian Airlines flight shot down over Ukraine? Where do you draw the line on what we see there?
Well, MH17, heaven help us, you're not going to be showing pictures of people blasted apart in a plane crash. That ain't going to happen. There is no upside to that.
No.
You know, it's funny because ethical issues exist in the point where they are difficult choices. There are very easy choices, ethical choices to make, and the easy choice there is that you wouldn't go near it. And I know that there were reporters who got in trouble because they went through remnants, passports, other little things in there. And I know some of the journalists who did that I have greatest respect for as journalists and human beings, but plainly the feedback on that and the instinct you hope that you would have at the time is that you wouldn't do that. You can tell a story without that.
Michelle, how did you deal with this at the Oz? Do you remember?
Yeah, I certainly do. I edited the paper in which we put coverage of MH17 on the front page, and in fact, it became a case in which we had to answer to the Press Council. We published a small photograph of the crash scene. It was below the fold on the front page of the paper, you know, and it was small, but you could see bodies in the field. And it went with a powerful piece of colour writing, which I think was also run in New York publications. And I think Hugh mentioned it earlier. We need to make judgments every day when we encounter these graphic images about whether we run them or not, where the filter. And I think in that case, we received that Press Council complaint, and in fact we received some complaints about our publication of that photo. And the Press Council asked us, I think the wording of their request to us is interesting for this audience, perhaps. They say we had to show whether their public interest was served by running that photo. And I think with that piece of writing, it was reasonably powerful. And as editors, we then have to use the tools at our disposal, whether it's pixelation, cropping, the prominence of it, the position of it, to minimise distress that might be caused to relatives. I mean, in this case, there were Australian victims, obviously, on that flight. And so one consideration that you have in this case that you may not, when you're covering overseas, natural disasters or disasters, is the ability of family members here, through identification of clothing and so on, to be able to identify their loved ones involved in the crash. But I mentioned that the Press Council asked us to respond, and we did, and they found in our favour in this case, and that the efforts that we had gone to, they thought, were adequate.
Alex, children do see BuzzFeed. In fact, my 12-year-old was telling me the other day how much she enjoys it, and I know she has no choice. The radio's on all the time at home. Both of her parents are journalists. If she's not careful, she ends up seeing a commercial bulletin and the ABC, but she goes to BuzzFeed. So we know that young people go to BuzzFeed. How much does that come into the thinking of the images you show there?
Well, I think being able to work in the online space means that you actually have a lot more tools at your disposal. You don't have just one image that's going to be your front page. You can choose from a number of different pictures to show your story. And in the instance of really graphic images, we usually do a picture with a blur over the top, and you have a warning, and then you say click to reveal. And then so if people want to see it, they can. We also have filters you can put on a story to make sure that they don't show up in people's Facebook feeds or in certain parts of the site, so they'll just be in the news part of the website. If there was an image that we didn't feel comfortable putting in a story, but you can still give them the option of clicking on a link to an external site. So I think there's a few more options there. I think you've got a bit more room to move in digital.
Michelle, you've already touched on another image that we're going to talk about, and that's Khalid Sharif's son struggling to hold up. And this is it was a pixelated image,
yes.
But he was struggling to hold up the severed head on the front page. Without going too far down the track of the Press Council, what was the thinking behind that decision? Because that is not a, okay, we'll just show it. That's a discussion, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. It was. I remember the discussion well. It was involving all the senior editors of the paper, really sitting down and looking at this image, discussing where we would run it. In this case, we did run it above the fold. We ran it prominently. We pixelated the 7-year-old son of Khalid Sharif so that he couldn't be identified. But, you know, that story, of course, became the biggest story in the world the following day. It was splashed in the Sun and in the New York papers.
I think you pixelated the head and blanked out the face.
The face of the boy, yes. Yeah. So both. You couldn't see the graphic nature of the decapitated head, and nor could you see the little boy's face. But we identified him, obviously. The power of that picture and the story was that this was a little boy who, I don't know, a matter of months, a year before, had been playing in the suburbs of Western Sydney. Of course it was offensive. It was absolutely grotesque and stomach-churning, that scene. But then you get to the editorial decisions you need to make about whether some things. I think Campbell Reid, who was on the panel before, sent out a note after we published that photo saying sometimes editors need to be brave. They may need to make courageous decisions about what people need to know, not just what they may want to know.
I'll get to you in a moment, Hugh, because I'm very conscious that of all of us, so many images pour into TV newsrooms of which we see a fraction. But Alex, I don't think you were at BuzzFeed at the time, but BuzzFeed actually were a bit cute about this story, as I recall. It reported the story as a media furore and published both the picture and a picture of the front page of The Australian featuring the picture. We essentially got two pictures. So how do you think, you know, an organisation like the one you work for should treat these sorts of stories, this one in particular, which doesn't have to worry about the above-the-fold issue, but does have to worry that everybody can see it?
I mean, I think at that point where they were reporting it, the story, as Michelle had said, had been splashed everywhere. So, I think that gets to a point of saturation where it's on every TV news bulletin, you know, around the world, in the papers, online. And I think you could make that call then that it is okay to show that picture if that's what everyone is already seeing.
Hugh, what did Ten do? And I'm wondering if you were still in the gallery at this point, but can you recall?
I don't specifically recall. I imagine we probably would have run it with the appropriate blurrings. It's an interesting shot and an interesting dilemma. Think of it this way. If that had been a picture that had come in from Raqqa of an anonymous Islamic State fighter's son with a severed head, would you have run it? And the answer there is no. So the significance of the story lay in the fact, as was pointed out, that somehow or other, out of our own suburbs, out of our own culture and out of our own norms, has emerged this anomaly by which it seems like a cool thing or an okay thing to get your son to be there holding up a severed head. And so I think it was an important picture. I think if I was in a newspaper, I would have taken the same set of actions. You know, I don't think it's one particularly to dwell on. You know, it's not one you're going to constantly return to as a picture. But once the point's been made, you know, it's been made.
And another point is, and this goes to the issue of TV newsrooms in particular, half an hour or so of determined looking on the web found a gallery of horrors that was one of the milder examples of. Those are images that the normal public will never see because they're just far too awful.
If I can say on that, I know of one individual who, when the decapitations were going on, the Jihadi John or whatever, when that first hit with the Foley case, there is a executive of a TV network who has suffered psychological damage from watching that and making the decisions of it, and has been effectively out of action since. You shouldn't underestimate what it is to look at this stuff.
This is something that is an issue. This is the Media Report on RN online and the ABC Radio app. I'm Richard Adey. We're coming to you today from the Storyology Conference in Sydney. It's a panel discussion we've got going on, short and curly, ethical conundrums solved before your eyes. And with me is Hugh Rimmington, who presents 10 Eyewitness News in Sydney, and Michelle Gunn, editor of The Weekend Australian, and BuzzFeed political reporter Alex Lee. Let's get on to another question, which is about the language we use to describe someone like Mann Monis. How ought we to label people who do terrible things? Alex, should we call him, as he was called, a terrorist or a madman or a dangerous attention seeker who became a killer?
Well, first of all, I don't really know why anyone is using the term madman in 2015. You know, I think we're far beyond that point with our understanding of how we talk about the whole spectrum of mental illnesses and things like that. So at the same time, I think we have to be really careful about how we're using these labels, because I know that the way that we're talking about these things with the rise of IS, particularly with the way the government uses these terms, like a terrorist or extremist and things like that, and they're such powerful labels, and the media really has to question, what is the use of these? Are we actually giving meaning with this, or are we just making it easy for people to kind of jump to a conclusion? So I think that in the case of Mann Monis, it was a very complex case. He was a man who said he had links with a terrorist organisation, probably didn't, also had a whole number of psychological problems and a criminal background. I think it was right at the time for most media organisations to refer to him as the gunman, because we just didn't have enough information. I mean, even now, the inquest is still going about whether or not he should be classified a terrorist or not.
I was speaking to our national security editor about this yesterday, and he was saying, look, even the police themselves are divided over whether to call him a terrorist or not. And there's also no doubt that he was mentally unstable. However, probably the answer from my point of view is that these things aren't mutually exclusive. He committed a terrorist act, of that I have no doubt, but also that he was mentally unstable. I know there is some debate about the definition of terrorism, but, and it's not just, we shouldn't just think that it's Islamist, you know,
no,
terrorists.
Indeed.
Timothy McVeigh was a terrorist, obviously, you know, Anders Breivik in Norway was an Islamophobic terrorist.
Hugh, what about Farhad Jabbar Khalil Muhammad, the 15-year-old boy who shot and killed Curtis Cheng, well, last month? Was he a terrorist? Should we label him that way?
I think you certainly can. He was radicalised to do violence in the name of whatever it was that he thought he was doing. I don't know the exact circumstances, moment by moment, of the death of Curtis Cheng, how much he was even aware that this guy was about to shoot him, or anything, whether he even had any awareness of terror or fear.
I don't believe he was.
I don't believe he did. But, I mean, had he been aware of it, he would well have felt terrorised by it.
I just wonder, because this is a 15-year-old boy we're talking about.
Well, it goes to the question, really, almost of kind of legal consent. If you're deemed in a legal sense not to be able to form an opinion to do something, are you disqualified from all the consequences of your actions? And there is a certain legal precedent that says, yes, we have juvenile courts, we treat minors in different ways. I think it was, so far as we know, and so far as we look at his actions, he intended to act as a terrorist. He wanted to have that for himself. And Man Monis wanted to go out as a terrorist. I think he's a rather pathetic character, Man Monis. And I think we let him off the hook by calling him a madman. He had had a number of court appearances for sexual offences as an accessory to murder. None of his lawyers put up that he was incapable of defending himself on the grounds of madness. They sought bail and got bail for him. So if he wasn't mad before, why do we call him mad now? That kind of, in a sense, lets him off the hook. Oh, poor man, he was mad. I choose to see him neither as a terrorist or a madman. I don't want to give him that label as a get-out clause in some ways. I want to see him as a pathetic, violent piece of work. Because otherwise, to glorify him as a terrorist encourages others to do similar acts of glory. Whereas if he's perceived as a pathetic man, it's somehow not quite as strong a recruiting sergeant for others.
Alex, you wanted to come in there.
Yeah, I was just going to add that I think we often miss when we're wondering whether to apply the term terrorist to someone or is their motivation. You know, one of the main motivations for a terrorist is that they want to create a whole culture of fear amongst the public. I don't know if some of the people who had racially motivated shootings in the US, whether that was their intention or whether they just it just came from a place of personal hatred. I just think we have to be careful and probably come up with a whole range of more terms that we can use, because the best thing we can do is be as specific as we can.
All right, let's get on with the next conundrum, which could be inelegantly encapsulated this way. So don't give them oxygen or give them enough rope. This is also known as the Zaki Mallah dilemma. Michelle, you've been in the room trying to work out how to deal with Zaki Mallah. Not with him in the room with you, but what did you decide?
I sent reporters out in 2003 to interview Zaki Mallah. That was before his arrest, and it was when he first came to prominence, if you like. I was a Sydney bureau chief at the time. It was 2003, and we published a front-page story of him at that time, the tortured world of an angry young man. And so it was. Our newspaper in 2012, and I think this became a topic of discussion when he was on Q&A recently, did publish another interview with him in which he presented himself as a reformed, by that stage, you know, 11 years later after everything that had come to pass, urged people not to go to Syria and Iraq to fight. This became relevant when there was such a furor over ABC allowing him on as a questioner on Q&A. And the question was put, well, you know, newspapers have interviewed him. Yes, of course they have. In fact, media organisations across the board in the previous 15 years have interviewed him. I think that was part of an attempt to make this a freedom of speech issue, and I don't think the Q&A furore was about freedom of speech. I think it was about the sort of judgments that we've just spoken about in relation to earlier topics, the filter that you apply as an editor or an executive producer of a program when you're deciding who to have on the program and in what capacity.
Well, Hugh, your TV's your world. Should they have let Zaki Mallah speak on Q&A?
I'm going to somewhat dodge the question by saying this. We had this very similar debate on the project last week because the Hizbut Tahrir conference had been taking place and there had been a lot of stuff that emerged out of that. So there was an active debate just last week about whether someone from Hizbut Tahrir should be interviewed on the project. And my view of it as a freedom of speech issue is that I think these guys are entitled, as long as they're not advocating violence, are entitled to present a whole bunch of points of view. But I'm not going to be their megaphone. Zaki Mallah was an interesting case. Some of it was written up as that this was a guy who was potentially dangerous to other members of the audience. You know, he had a history. That was Malcolm Turnbull's argument. And I think one of the problems with the Zaki Mallah one was that he had his initial question went to a ticklish point about getting rid of citizenships, I think. But then it got into a debate, and he was able to shout down the minister. And
well, actually, and it was 6 or 7 minutes later. It was almost the end of the show. Steve Shobo said something to him, and he responded then. That is what caused the problem. And what he rather clumsily and angrily said was, you know, wouldn't be surprised if people listening to this, young people, would go off and fight. What he never said was, people should go off and fight.
Yeah. Well, it shows also how fevered the place is. And also there's a little bit of, there were people waiting with baseball bats to beat the ABC at any opportunity, and I think that fed into it as well. Zaki Mallah sits absolutely on the line because he's not advocating violence. He has some history. Do you put him on? Do you not put him on? One of the things about this is that if you take no risks, if you don't put dissenting voices, if you don't put a whole bunch of people up there, then in fact all the interesting conversations are happening away from TV. You get left there as the good, proper, incredibly boring, you know, carpet slippers and pipe type of outfit that never says anything that could possibly offend anyone. I don't think that's a good result.
That's part of it, isn't it, Alex? I mean, this is now Q&A has been folded into ABC News, but then it was part of TV. What it wants is people to watch it and people to talk about it. And anyone who saw Richard Dawkins versus Cardinal George Pell basically talk past one another will know that it's not always about generating light. Mm. It's about generating controversy.
So yeah, I think if the ABC had known all the comments that Zaki Mallah would have made in his entirety, they wouldn't have put him on. But the fact is they did come up spontaneously. And I don't think that it was, you know, from their point of view, not looking back in hindsight, but where they were at the time, a mistake to put him on. Because the whole debate about radicalisation is something that's happening, but there's this huge half of the argument that's completely missing, and that's the voices of these people who feel like they're being targeted by the government and that there's people pointing their fingers at them, but we never hear from them. And Zaki Mallah was not the best spokesperson for them. His arguments weren't particularly well phrased. But at least we heard them. And at least if we have that voice there in the public, then we can take it from there. And people who have that experience can then step up and talk about it in a better way. So I kind of would defend the ABC for that.
The other option which discusses whether you put him just in a question in a box, video question, you control what's happened there. And that might have got them off the hook.
But what happened, I mean, the response from the minister was really good, and it meant that the debate came up, the question from him, it got shut down, both sides of the argument were heard. Like, I think a lot of the outrage was unjustified, in my opinion.
What about a different thing, Michelle? So the Dutch politician Geert Wilders, who's very controversial views about Islam, he was recently in Australia to launch an anti-Muslim political party. Should we report his views?
Yes. I think it picks up what Hugh mentioned earlier about Hizbut Tahrir. On The Australian, we published a piece by Udmund Badar from Hizbut Tahrir on our opinion page. Now, we wouldn't do so every week. We don't want to give him a megaphone. Similarly, we wouldn't give Geert Wilders a megaphone. But I think we want to give our readers a range of views and to stimulate debate. So we often open the debate, whether it's, I guess, over a two-state solution, for example. We will have speakers on either side of that debate. Same with climate change. We had Jeff Cousins write a piece recently, and some of our readers didn't like what he had to say at all. But it's important. I think it's a question of where you draw the line and the frequency with which you go to particular voices and the balance that you bring to the debate. And I would just say that I think picking up on what Hugh said about boring television, there was no doubt that Zaki's appearance on that program was a gotcha moment, as it has been described. It was obviously designed to be explosive and interesting. Now, it's a question of whether you think that it should have been handled differently, in that that question be pre-recorded, and that would have addressed perhaps some of the security concerns, and also would have given the executive producer of that program greater control.
That is where we have to leave it. Can you please join me in thanking our panel, Hugh Rimmington, Michelle Gunn and Alex Lee.
A panel discussion on ethics and journalism, hosted by Richard Eadie. You're listening to Media Network Plus, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. Let's now turn our attention to propagation, what's been happening, and what we can expect. Here's our propagation editor, Glenn Hauser.
Keith from IPS in Australia, the global HF propagation forecast through October 1st. Normal at low latitudes, poor to fair at middle latitudes, fair to poor at high latitudes. From Space Weather South Africa through October 1st, magnetic conditions, minor storm. Shortwave fade-outs unlikely, MUF unstable. From Met Office UK through October 2nd, solar activity very low, a 30% chance of isolated common class flares. Geomagnetic activity at G2 moderate storm level September 30th, and a slight chance for G3, declining to G1 on October 1st and 2nd. From Peter Coleman, OK1 MGW in Czechia, the geomagnetic field will be active to disturbed on September 29th and 30th. Quiet to active September 30th, October 1st, 2nd, 17th, and 18th. Quiet to unsettled October 3rd to 5th and 11th. Mostly quiet on October 5th, 9th, 10th, 12th, 15th, 16th, and 19th. Quiet on October 6th to 8th, 13th, and 14th. From SWPC in Boulder, geomagnetic field likely to reach G2 moderate storm levels September 28th to 30th, ANK indices of 35 and 6, and G1 minor storm levels October 1st, 2nd, and 17th at 25 or 20 and 5, due to multiple recurrent coronal hole high-speed solar wind streams. Active conditions expected October 3rd at 16 and 4. Lowest A's and K's of 5 and 2, on October 6th to 14th. Solar flux rising from 80 October 4th to a peak of 95 on October 15th to 18th. William Hepburn's VHF, UHF, DX maps show extreme tropospheric ducting off the Southern California coast, also between Mozambique and Madagascar, both only through September 30th. Off the coast of Western Sahara and Mauritania through October 3rd. Various parts of the Mediterranean, especially between Cyprus and Crete, across the Red Sea and the Yemeni coast all week.
Thanks, Glenn. And with that, we've come to the end of this edition of Media Network Plus from PCJ Radio International. Our email address is very simple. It's mnp@pcjmedia.com. On behalf of the whole team, I'm Keith Powell, wishing you well, saying so long, take care. We'll see you in 7 days' time. 73 and 88 to the ladies.